You're listening to Gameplay with Matthew Kaws on TSN 1050. Embrace the odds.
I want winners.
So as mentioned before, for the next 4 weeks, we started yesterday. We're going to go through each and every NFL team with a different writer, analyst, just to preview the upcoming NFL season and to give each team a little bit of air to breathe, look at it from a fantasy perspective, a betting perspective, and really just a football perspective. And we're doing this for the next 4 weeks. Take a different look at these teams because we want to get you prepared for the glorious arrival of the NFL season. And joining me today covers the Cincinnati Bengals. It is Charlie Goldsmith from Inquirer, which is basically Cincinnati.com, and he covers the Reds and the Bengals. Charlie, thank you so much for joining the show today.
How you doing?
I'm doing really well. The Bengals are, what the Bengals were last year was just such a shot in the arm of excitement, just with all the receivers, with Joe Burrow. You know what, actually, let's start here. Instead of looking ahead, I want to look back for a second. How surprising, because 2 years ago, the Bengals, and part of it was because of the Joe Burrow injury, they didn't really make much noise. They went from, a 6-win, 5-win team to getting to the Super Bowl and keeping that game close. How shocking was last year for you?
Yeah, the Bengals head coach Zach Taylor reflected on this, and he said there were a lot of owners who would have fired him after 2 years where he only had 6 wins, where Joe Burrow got hurt, the offensive line was awful, and the defense was searching for its foundational pieces. You know, what ended up happening is we didn't realize it in the moment, but there were strokes of genius moves like drafting Ja'Marr Chase over Penei Sewell, finding the kicker of the decade, it feels like, in Evan McPherson. These really specific defensive players they targeted that created this really versatile group that could fly around the field. And it was shocking because it all came together so quickly.
It really did. And then, you next thing you blink, and they're dominating the Chiefs in the second half of the AFC Championship game, and here we are. You know, in a weird sort of way, the unintended consequence of Joe Burrow getting injured the year before, it meant they had a losing record, they got to pick 5th overall, and they chose Ja'Marr Chase. It does make you wonder a little bit, if Burrow was fully healthy his rookie season, they probably would have won some more games and maybe it would have been Devonta Smith instead. Oh, I think I was a call dropped. I think for a second I thought, did I just blow Charlie Goldsmith's brain there? We'll get him back on the line. He covers the Cincinnati Bengals for the Inquirer, which again is Cincinnati.com. And I always love sort of that, just the unintended consequences. You look at the San Antonio Spurs. You know, one of the reasons they became an incredible team? Because they lost David Robinson for basically an entire season. They had one of the worst records. They won the draft lottery, and they were able to get Tim Duncan. By the way, Craig Popovich took over as head coach right after they drafted Tim Duncan. And that's sort of the interesting unintended consequences. Same thing for the Bengals. We got Charlie back. So, yeah, Charlie, I was throwing it out there. If Joe Burrow doesn't get injured his rookie year, maybe they win a couple more games. Maybe they're not picking number 5. Maybe Ja'Marr Chase is off the board.
And that's certainly the decision and the connection that changed everything. Ja'Marr Chase right now is a top 5 receiver in the NFL. I heard something today about how Zach Taylor has been waiting for his entire career to build an offense around a receiver with exactly the skill set that Ja'Marr has. The receiver he's been dreaming of, with the versatility and the athleticism and the football IQ, being able to use him all over the field, that's who Ja'Marr is. And now he unlocks Burrow's ability to make plays outside the pocket. He unlocks Zach Taylor's flexibility as a coach, and maybe most importantly, he unlocks, some opportunities for other wide receivers like T. Higgins and Tyler Boyd to get favorable matches.
Where do we go for an encore for Joe Burrow? The last 5 games, completing 72%, averaging over 350 yards, 12 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. It's funny, with guys like him and Chase, statistically, it's hard. I don't know. To me, it feels like hard to ask them more out of them. What are your expectations for that duo?
Yeah, last year Joe Burrow led the NFL in completion percentage and he led the NFL in yards per attempt.
Oh.
He was literally the most efficient and the most explosive quarterback. It is harder to get better than that, but the next step is, you know, how defenses change the way they guard him and how Burrow responds to that. That is viewed as a strength of Burrow, the way he reads defenses, the way he responds to adjustments. But here they come, because all offseason, you know, defenses have been scheming up the next wave of ideas to go at Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase.
What do you expect from the offensive line? If we look at the Achilles heel of the Cincinnati Bengals, it was that. Burrow took 51 sacks in the regular season, 19 in four playoff games. Then in the offseason, they bring in three new linemen, including Lael Collins from Dallas. How much better do you expect that offensive line to be this year versus last?
Yeah, the offensive line they had last year, look at the guys they started, you know, for pretty much the entire season. Two of them don't have jobs in the NFL anymore.
Mm.
One of them signed basically a, we'll give you a shot, but with very little guaranteed deal with the Bears, who have the worst offensive line in football. One of them is now the Bengals' backup guard.
Oof.
And then the left tackle is the same. So they went out and got three true, tried and true veteran reliable starters. And Lael Collins and Alex Kappa and Ted Karras, they were more aggressive in fixing their line than they literally had ever been in franchise history. And they did it for a reason, because, you know, the offensive line really can help the Bengals be more consistent this year.
I love that answer, because it's not just about praising or talking about who was brought in. It's how bad were the guys who they booted out. I didn't even put that perspective of just how bad some of those linemen were last year. We're joined by Charlie Goldsmith, who covers the Bengals for The Inquirer, which is, I keep saying, which is Cincinnati.com, because some people hear The Inquirer and they think National Enquirer. I want to make sure that is not true. What's the pushback would you give for people that say that the team will regress? There were seven teams last year with a better scoring differential than the Bengals. All those playoff wins were one score. For people out there going, they're going to regress like the 49ers did when they went to the Super Bowl a couple years ago, what do you say to them?
Yeah, the Bengals GM said they were 37 seconds away from winning the Super Bowl. So there's very little room to improve, and there's a lot of room statistically to regress. And
yeah.
They did get lucky in a lot of ways last season. Their opponents missed a lot of field goals. Their opponents were more injured than most opponents that other teams were facing. And then in the playoffs, you know, each of the last three games, they made great turnovers to win the games. And turnovers aren't something you can always rely on as a pass, because they can really fluctuate. So I think the Bengals will regress probably in those areas. But I think with the improvement on the offensive line, the defense is way deeper with the rookies they brought in. And then when you look at the guys they lost, you know, the only key players who they lost at all were a guy who would basically be their backup defensive tackle this year and their starting tight end. And they signed another starting tight end in free agency, and they drafted a backup defensive tackle in the third round. So they feel like they've replaced literally every key player they lost. So for those reasons, I think there's room for them to maybe be less lucky, but still have the same 10-7 record.
You know, from a fantasy perspective, everyone loves the Bengals because there's such clarity. There's the star quarterback, the star receiver, the legit number two receiver, and they're one of the few teams that has just one running back and it's not a rotation. Is there anything for people getting ready for their fantasy football leagues? Is there any advice you would give them, either players to bump up or players to knock down in terms of rankings?
Yeah, looking at the receivers, they really do look at it as whoever is open, they're going to get the ball. They don't really feed targets to specific players, so they are kind of who they are in that area. But one of, you know, the absolute biggest storylines in training camp is they went out and signed a veteran tight end in Hayden Hurst, and they're excited about him. They're scheming up specific plays in the red zone especially, because he gives them this physicality and this route running ability and the strength with his ability to create leverage and the size that, you know, they had a different style of tight end last season who wasn't as proficient at doing those things. And Hayden Hurst, I would bet, has caught as many passes as absolutely anyone during 11-on-11 drills in training camp. He is a tried and true receiving threat at tight end. And again, it's a new element that the Bengals plan to feature pretty often this season.
Charlie, before we let you go, we're doing this, asking each and every guest this question. On FanDuel, the Bengals' win total is at 9.5. Would you lean on the over or the under?
I'm at 10-7. I think they, again, they might have worse luck than they had last season, but I think the better roster gives them a shot to make it up. I have legitimate questions about the Ravens' pass rush and the Ravens' wide receiving corps. Obviously, the Browns carry a wide variety of questions at many different positions.
Yes.
And the Steelers, I think, are entering the year as the true underdog in the division because of their questions at quarterback, their inexperience at receiver, and some moving pieces they've had to try to replace on defense. So for those reasons, I see the Bengals as the favorite in the division. But I think especially with 1, 2, and 3, it's pretty close between the Bengals, Baltimore, and Cleveland.
You know, before I let you go, one of the things that's always confused me, I'd love to get your perspective. What happened in that second half of the AFC Championship game? I have not seen Patrick Mahomes look that bad. I mean, that might have been the worst I've ever seen him play. And it's not to take anything away from the Bengals' defense. It's a good defense. But I was just shocked by that second half. To me, it's one of the biggest mysteries. I'm curious what your eyes saw back in the AFC Championship game.
So the Bengals, when they built this defense, specifically wanted guys who were one, athletic, and two, football smart. Those were the top two things they prioritized. And they created, they used all this post-snap motion, and they only rushed three on the line of scrimmage, and they had safeties blitzing and defensive ends playing in coverage, and they changed the picture so consistently on Mahomes, and they executed that at such a high level to cover so much ground. Now, Mahomes had nowhere to throw the ball, and it was, I think, the most impressive defensive game plan I've ever seen in person.
It was just remarkable. It was unexpected. But, hey, again, it was a shot in the arm. It was new blood in the Super Bowl and made it very entertaining. Hey, Charlie, really appreciate. You can follow the man on Twitter at @CharlieG_. It's kind of a mysterious Twitter handle, really. And appreciate you joining the show today.
Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Take care. That is Charlie Goldsmith, who does cover the Cincinnati Bengals. And I do feel kind of bad. There's, like, the odds are they're not going to go back to the Super Bowl because only one team can do it. And if I look at, they are 12-1 on FanDuel. So the Bengals, they could actually in some ways improve as a team, but not have a season as good as they had last year. That, in some ways, that's a weird position to be in, Chris.
No, it really is. When you think about it, anytime you improve, you think your odds of getting further in the playoffs would improve. But, I mean, given what that they overachieved last year, I think you bring up a very valid point. For me, I look at the Bengals. I do think they are the favorite in the AFC North. I look at their team, and they have the most depth. They have the most complete sort of package out of all the teams that are there. Charlie mentioned there's so many questions with the Browns at several positions.
It's Deshaun Watson. It's Deshaun Watson. The Browns are doomed. They're doomed this year. Take the under for them.
And then if you look at the Ravens, the Ravens have a pretty balanced team, but they really don't have a ton in the wide receiving core. They're going to rely a lot on Mark Andrews, and who knows if that's going to work out. So all of that is to say that I really do think the Bengals are in a great spot to win the division again. Whether they make it back to the Super Bowl, I mean, like you said, it's unlikely, but I could certainly see it happening, and you could get worse odds than 12-1.
Yeah, oh no, you can. And I have full belief and faith in Joe Burrow. And yeah, there's more value taking the Bengals to win the AFC North at +180 than the Bengals, I think, are +120. So it's there's certainly a little bit more value there. And finally, I brought it up, but the Cincinnati Bengals, they're a safe space, aren't they, for fantasy football? You know who they are. You know who's getting the ball. I mean, barring injuries, but you have a pretty clear idea of exactly where the ball is going to go on offense.
It's true, yeah. That's one thing fantasy drafters absolutely love. Defined roles where there is no murkiness. For this very reason, I will never draft New England Patriots players, ever.
No.
I don't care who I miss out. I don't care if I miss out on the RB1, the wide receiver one.
RB1. They don't have an RB1.
No, I meant the RB1. A guy that I do like on the Bengals, though, is second-year running back Chris Evans. He's kind of like a shifty, scat-back kind of profile. He had some really good years at Michigan, and he's very good in the pass game, and he's very good at pass blocking as well. So whenever Joe Mixon needs a bit of a blow, I think Evans is going to start to work his way into the game. He will have to pass Samaje Perine on the depth chart, but I could see that happening in pretty short order.
Yeah, so this is the guy that you either keep an eye on for your waiver wire, or if you're in a deep league, you take a chance on him late.
Chris Evans.
Chris. And by the way, easy name, you know, just Captain America. All right, on the other side, let's play some sound from Serena Williams. This was from, like, yesterday at a presser at the Toronto Open, talking, I mean, basically just saying, yep, I'm retiring super soon. So we'll get into a little conversation about Serena and also get back to the opening thought, which is all about Kevin Durant. That's coming up. You are listening to Gameplay on TSN 1050, which is brought to you by FanDuel. Bet on all your favorite teams on the FanDuel Sportsbook app. One last thought about the Cincinnati Bengals, and this is Gameplay. I'm your host, Matthew Kaz, right here on TSN 1050. Is it odd that their Super Bowl odds are plus 2,200, 22 to 1? They went to the Super Bowl last year. They didn't have any major losses in the offseason. They're not coming off of some crazy injuries. Their quarterback was not implicated in, you know, 20-plus counts of alleged sexual abuse or assault. And yet there are 10 teams in the NFL with shorter odds to win the Super Bowl than the Bengals. Is that some sort of, oh, the Super Bowl hangover if you lose, even though statistically there's no merit to that?
I can see it, yeah. I mean, I do think that is part of the reason that number is baked out to be the way that it is. I mean, I don't know about you, but I do expect them to make the playoffs. I would say, like, whether it's the AFC North or the wild card, I would say they're about as close of a lock to make it as there is.
Ten teams had it. It seems weird. It just seems just like I tell you, okay, team went to the Super Bowl, nearly won it. They've got one of the best young quarterbacks, one of the best receivers in the league. Their best pass rusher had, you know, 14 or whatever sacks. They're healthy. They didn't lose anyone. And, in fact, they improved their one Achilles heel on the offensive line. I don't tell you the team. I just give you those are the facts. And then I say, oh, by the way, the odds makers have 10 teams ahead of them to win the Super Bowl. That seems strange.
Well, how many teams would you say could match that same criteria? Like, I would say there's probably at least 5 or 6 off the top of your head, no?
I'm thinking, like, just off the top of my head, I'm thinking Baltimore were 8-3, 8-4 when Lamar Jackson got hurt. And the Denver Broncos brought in Russell Wilson. So that means their chances are better, but it also means on the other end, Seattle's chances are worse. Like, I guess they have to pick someone from the AFC South to win the, you know, maybe they get the Titans out of them and who went 12-5. I don't know. Just
I hope not. My God.
No, but no one's taking the Titans. As we said before, I feel bad for Tennessee. To me, the two biggest stories. Now, not locally. We'll get to the Jays and really talk about Kikuchi. But one is Serena Williams. Have a listen to this. This was from a presser yesterday from the Toronto Open where it's basically come out. Serena plans to retire from professional tennis after the U.S. Open.
At this point in your career or your life, what is it that continues to drive you or keeps you hungry in the sport?
I don't know. I guess there's just a light at the end of the tunnel.
What is that like?
I don't know. I'm getting closer to the light, so that's yeah. So that's like lately. That's been it for me. I can't wait to get to that light.
I know you're joking, but can you?
I'm not joking.
Okay, so then explain to me what the light is to you. What the light represents?
Freedom. Yeah, I love playing though. It's like it's amazing, but. You know, it's like, I can't do this forever. So it's just like, sometimes you just want to try your best to enjoy the moments and do the best that you can.
She feels at peace with this decision. Your thoughts, Chris?
I kind of wonder if she joined Aaron Rodgers in taking an ayahuasca retreat,
right?
Because that was pretty out there.
What is ayahuasca, by the way? I keep hearing that Aaron Rodgers took it, but I have no idea what that is.
I don't know for sure, but I believe it is a hallucinogen that is found in the desert, and it's commonly used by people who live in the desert.
Gotcha.
And it also is known to have extremely long-lasting effects. Mm. So, like, it's not just, like, a 30-minute or an hour thing.
Right.
If you take it, it's like you're like that for a couple days, apparently. Jesus.
So then you want to be in the desert. You don't want to be anywhere where there's a lot of traffic. You don't want to operate any heavy machinery. That's kind of what you're saying, right? So, okay, more impressive. This would be a great poll question. More impressive contract by Scott Boras. Getting Max Scherzer, $210 million. Bryce Harper, $330 million. Or Yusei Kikuchi, $36 million.
The latter. Honestly, I think you summed it up earlier. Those big contracts, like, outside of a few small details here and there, they kind of do themselves. The market sets itself. The player knows roughly what he's going to get. But if you can go get a guy like Kikuchi, you know, $30, $40 million, I'm sure that he looks very favorably on that for sure.
And I hate doing the hindsight thing, but when you look back now, that three-year, $36 million deal, here's Scott Boras' quotes before he signed with the Blue Jays. How many teams wouldn't want an all-star pitcher on their staff? Teams are coming to us and letting us know that he is a priority for them because they need starting pitching. Scott Boras hoodwinked Ross Atkins.
It's a trap.
Yes. Thank you, Admiral Akbar. It is. In fact, I would say negotiating with Scott Boras is often more dangerous than coming out of warp speed, seeing the Death Star, and suddenly realizing at the last second, the shields are up.
It's a trap.
Holy bleep. Why didn't someone tell us sooner? We could travel at warp speed and no one knows that. Anyway. When he says that who wouldn't want an all-star pitcher, that's the equivalent of, this actor won an Emmy, and then you find out later it was a daytime Emmy. You know, it's them co-hosting on a game show.
Hey, don't you be slandering game shows in front of me. I love myself some game shows.
I love game shows as well, okay? Steve Harvey is a legend.
Oh, yeah.
But just think about Kikuchi. First two seasons in baseball, ERA of 5.39. Then in 2021, he puts together a nice run of 16 starts, ERA of 3.48. He gets to go to the All-Star game. Hey, I'm an All-Star. Then what did he do after the All-Star game? He had an ERA of 6, and opponents were hitting 300 on him. Now he's come to the Blue Jays, and this guy, 15 of his 19 starts, he's given them 15 outs or less. Like, this is just, and what did we see yesterday? 2 walks, 3-run home run in the first, 25 pitches. There's a reason why I loved taking the over of 1.5 runs in the first inning at plus 196. I got that one right because of Kikuchi on the mound.
I mean, everything that you just presented is factual, and it really does point towards the struggles that he's had. But what exactly do the Blue Jays do? Like, they're not going to cut bait on this guy after one year.
They have no choice. They have no choice. Like, John Schneider says he's going to get his opportunities. He's getting his opportunities because Ross Stripling is hurt, because Ryu, you might never see him again, and because Nate Pearson has spent his entire career injured. That's the only reason every 5 days people are banging the over, because Kikuchi's on the mound.
I just don't see a solution other than buying him out. But I mean, I don't think any front office group is going to want to come out after three, four months and be like, you know what, this actually isn't going to work out. Like,
yeah, it's a bleeping nightmare right now. And listen, I hope you're wrong. Yeah, he's got great stuff. He's like one of the hardest throwers on the team. The results haven't been there. They've not been there, and no one is surprised. We were all waiting for it, and it happened. Speaking of something we're not surprised, Kevin Durant, not happy. Matt Brooks, who covers the Brooklyn Nets for Nets Daily, is going to join the show next. And we get back into the conversation of Durant has now told the owner, it's me. You got to get rid of Sean Marks or Steve Nash, or you got to get rid of me. Has the circus gotten even crazier? That's coming up next on Gameplay. In this business, in sports media, the hardest thing is when you cover a team that is relevant. I remember when the Toronto Maple Leafs, the year before they got Austin Matthews, they had, you know, like the worst record in hockey. There was nothing to talk about. It made it very difficult. Then there is the Brooklyn Nets, who feel like the easiest team to cover because there is always something to talk about. And now with the news that Kevin Durant, it's been leaked, and that's a conversation of itself, that he went to the owner, Joe Tsai, the owner of the Brooklyn Nets, and said, hey, you got to get rid of the general manager and the head coach. Otherwise, definitely trade me. It's either them or me. So I start here with Matt Brooks, who covers the Brooklyn Nets for Nets Daily and basketball news. Matt, do you have the easiest job in the business?
Yeah, it's been a relaxing summer, right? Not too much to talk about. No drama.
Oh no! You've been busy. There's no doubt about that. You have been busier than most of the reporters who cover other NBA teams. But when it comes time to put pen to paper, I don't know if you do that. It's easier to at least have the storylines versus if you were covering the Oklahoma City Thunder.
No, yeah, I know. I'm kidding. Yeah, it. I mean, in a way, it is a little bit of a blessing to you know, be in this kind of dead period of the NBA calendar and be, you know, the lucky reporter who has a lot to talk about. I think day to day and things to keep an eye on, things to report on. So yeah, no, it's been a lot different in terms of off seasons compared to years past.
Well, let's go through the two main culprits who are 100% the reason to blame for Brooklyn not doing well, Steve Nash and Sean Marks. Those are the only two people responsible, at least according to Kevin Durant. Durant back in April had nothing but praise for Steve Nash, now wants him fired. Is this because, and again, I know this is speculation because Durant hasn't actually spoken on the record in ages. In your mind, is this just because they got swept by Boston?
Could be that. I looked at this whole report as kind of like a last-ditch effort by Durant to try to drum up some noise in the trade market. You know, this is such a huge ask of him to, I guess, put forth and kind of unprecedented. We've never seen an NBA superstar call for both the general manager and the head coach the way he has. And to me, that just suggests that he's looking to try to just generate something, create something that will get him out of Brooklyn. Because I do think ultimately that's what he wants. I get that he may have said that, hey, maybe we need new leadership in place. I really truly believe he's just done in Brooklyn. And that's kind of what, you know, he's going about this route to try to get himself out of the Nets organization.
Are we any closer as to why he's actually upset? I know that Sean Marks said back in May that the team needs to get back to finding their identity, which, you know, you can look at as a shot against the best players. But, I mean, Kyrie Irving was great in game one against Boston, but in the other three games, he shot 16 of 43 for 46 points. So Kyrie is partially to blame for the team losing in the first round. Are we any closer to understanding why it is Durant suddenly wants out?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing would just be that the Kyrie Irving situation is what spearheaded this. And what I mean by that is that he was eligible for, what, a four-year max? And the Nets effectively said, we're not going to do that. You're going to pick up your player option, and we're going to roll into next year, and we're going to see what we can do. And if things go well, then sure, we can revisit those conversations. I think that kind of rubbed Durant the wrong way. There have been other little moves, not bringing back Adam Harrington, who's Durant's shooting coach. He was actually a part of the Nets staff. They chose not to bring him back. So I think little things like that have sort of chipped away at this, and now we are kind of where we are.
I feel so nervous playing the role of armchair psychiatrist here when it comes to Kevin Durant, but it's not like the Nets said no to Giannis. You know, I mean, they said no to a guy who has been incredibly unreliable the last couple of years. No matter how you feel about Kyrie, if you take emotion out of it and just look at the end result, it just feels odd that Durant would be that upset for a team that gave him all the money when he was going to be out for a year and acquiesced to bringing in DeAndre Jordan and all these other moves, that he'd be that upset that the team wasn't willing to commit long term on a guy who hasn't been the steadiest player in Kyrie.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think it's also fair to look at Durant and say, like, hey, like, you know, you bring up Giannis. Giannis has been pretty steadfast about his commitment to Milwaukee, you know, Durant has moved around quite a bit. And this is a situation where, you know, he left Golden State because he effectively wanted his own thing, his own team. You know, I think splitting those duties with Steph was, you know, I don't think they had a contentious relationship, but I do think it weighed on Durant a little bit. So now he's in Brooklyn. And as you said, like, there have been a lot of roster moves over the last couple of years, even going back last year or 2 years ago, I guess, too, when they brought in somebody like Blake Griffin and LaMarcus Aldridge. These are all moves that Durant, you know, signed off on. He recruited those guys. So, yeah, I mean, it's not like this team has just completely said, oh, you know, whatever, like, you don't really have any say on anything. He's really had a lot of buy-in and say in the meeting table, I guess. I think that's also worth bringing up as well. It's kind of like, what makes Kevin Durant happy? I think that's a question that's worth asking at this point.
I don't think there's an answer. I think that is the single most difficult question to answer in the NBA since did they rig the draft for Patrick Ewing to go to the Knicks, is what can make Kevin Durant happy? Let's look at the other side, his opponent in all this, and he's got many. Again, by the way, we're joined by Matt Brooks, who covers the Nets for Nets Daily. Joe Tsai, what can you tell people about the owner of the Nets in terms of his personality and what his role in all of this is going to be?
Prideful guy, probably where I would start. This is a very prideful, figure who's pretty closely aligned with management. Him and Sean Marks have been pretty much in lockstep since, you know, Sean Marks was given a promotion, I think that was, 2 years ago, from Joe Tsai. So I would say that those two are really in lockstep. And actually, since Steve Nash has come aboard, he's also become pretty close with those two. So I would say in general, that's kind of the brain trust for the Nets right now, is those two plus Nash. Joe Tsai he's somebody, he allows Marks to, you know, do whatever moves he thinks are necessary to make the team as good as it can be. But he's also somebody that does respect, you know, the ethos, the culture of what the Nets are and you know, what I guess they're putting out in terms of the workplace. So I think that's kind of the best way to describe him.
A self-made billionaire, prideful, in line with management. Matt, could we be looking at the first ever example of an organization not caving to a superstar player?
Looks like it, right? Like it. I don't know what the resolution is right now, other than Kevin Durant getting traded. I just don't. I don't see how that's not where we end up, even as early as training camp. That kind of what it seems like right now.
If you're a Raptor fan, how nervous are you about that? Because I have this image in my head of Kevin Durant praising Nick Nurse, saying the boxing won a couple of years ago in the playoffs was brilliant, and then 13 months from now walking in to one of the bosses and saying, you got to fire Nick Nurse.
that's always something to worry about. I think as a Raptors fan, you're going to end up in pretty good standing no matter what. You have Scottie Barnes that you can build around, or you end up with Kevin Durant, who, by the way, is really, really good. And if you could put a roster around him and things fall right, you can compete for a championship. He's that good.
He is.
I think that's kind of what's lost in a lot of this in the last couple of months. Is like, I know that Durant didn't have a great series against Boston. There were a lot of things going on behind the scenes that really, I think, after seeing how the last couple of months have worked out for Durant, I don't think it's necessarily surprising to see him have the performance that he had against Boston. But, man, when he's locked in and he's good to go, that guy is amazing at basketball.
Oh, yeah. Fully healthy, locked in. You can argue the best player in the game, even at the age of 34. It just seems like he is his own worst enemy for reasons that seem like a mystery. He just seems like a thin-skinned, just self-entitled. And just the worst part is he is someone who is easy to root for in terms of what he does with the ball in his hand. It's just that everything else is such an incredible turnoff.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that perspective for sure. For him, it's just about finding the right ecosystem for him. And I will say, I'm surprised it wasn't with Kyrie Irving. I truly thought that this was going to be kind of what Durant was looking for. But you know, that obviously didn't work out. Now the Nets are in a position where they might have Kyrie and not KD, and I'm sure that was not what the plan was coming into this offseason.
Oh yeah, I mean, the crazy thing is that you know, it wasn't that long ago. We're like, oh God, look at that. It's Harden. It's Kyrie. It's Durant. This team's going to win multiple titles. And now we're at this point. Matt, before I let you go, the one guy I haven't really brought up is Ben Simmons. And there was reports out there, heard from Rick Bucher from Fox, that Ben Simmons logged off of a group chat when he was being asked if he was going to play in game four. What role do you think Ben Simmons, maybe none, I don't know, but what role has Ben Simmons played in this circus?
I mean, I don't know about the group chat story. I can't say I can confirm that one. But I will say that, you know, in terms of how he's progressing, he's just been kind of focusing on his rehab. Nets are really optimistic about him, whether or not Kevin Durant is here in Brooklyn. So I think his rehab has gone well. They expect him to be there by training camp. And they just want to see what they've got. You know, he is for as accomplished he is a little bit of a mystery box in a way. We just haven't seen him in, a full season. So I think they're very optimistic about him, where he's, how he's looking, I guess, and what he's going to do for the Nets going forward.
Matt, where can people find your content? Because, again, there's other reporters out there that have a much lighter load than you. You certainly have one of the more fascinating ones. Where can people find your work?
You can find me on Twitter, at MattBrooksNBA. I post everything there, articles, podcasts, videos, anything else I do. That'll all be there. So, yeah, that's definitely the best place to find me.
And easy to spell, Matt Brooks, NBA. That is Matt with two T's. Hey, Matt, thank you so much. Appreciate you joining the show today. The chaos around the Nets continues. And, we'll just see what the next chapter is. All the best.
Thank you.
Take care. That is Matt Brooks. And again, reporting for the Brooklyn Nets for Nets Daily and NBA content at basketballnews.com. Before I go to break, we go to our producer, Chris Horvat. What do you got, Chris?
Did you just say Matt with two T's? Is there such thing as a Matt with one T?
Oh, yeah. There are these people I don't trust. There's not many of them out there, but there is Matthew, where they spell the Matthew with one T. And I don't trust them.
No, and I can see why.
Yeah, I run into them, and I'm like, I cross the other side of the street.
And that's like me with Chris's with a K. Can't do that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, what about Brian? Do you accept Brian with a Y, or does it have to be with an I?
Well, I will not slander the main host who follows this show, so I will say yes. I love Brian with a Y.
I don't know. Listen. Hayes is fantastic. The Y instead of the I, let's just say that. I've arched eyebrow with the Y, Brian. So how about that? Is that fair?
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, aesthetically, it looks nice on paper. He's got a Y in his last name, so a Y in the first name. Why not?
I don't know about that. I kind of like the I. Anyway, on the other side of the show, let's play one of the coolest sounds from Hard Knocks. Jamal Williams for the Detroit Lions. He was trying to get his team pumped. We'll play that for you in just a moment right here on Gameplay. Now, normally when someone says it's the 34th anniversary of blank, you ask yourself, well, who cares? It's the 34th. We're humans. We like round numbers or fives. 25th anniversary? Fantastic. 26th anniversary? Get out of here! We'll see in 4 years at the 30th. But on this day, 34 years ago, the Edmonton Oilers got Jimmy Carson, Martin Shelanoff, 3 first-round picks, and $15 million in cold hard cash. As the LA Kings got Mike Krusniewski, Marty McSorley, and Wayne Gretzky. That's right, the 34th anniversary of the Wayne Gretzky trade happened this day, and it was truly one of those seminal moments of, wait a minute, they traded that guy? Oh, that means anyone can be traded. I would ask Chris your memories of that. You were not born.
I was going to say zero, nothing. I have no memory of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was young. I was like 13 at the time when that deal happened. But it was wild. Like, just it's one of those where everyone in the Canadian, just every not even just sports fans, just every Canadian, when they're, well, what? Yeah, I mean, most people, even the most casual, even people that really aren't hockey fans, they knew who Gretzky was. The guy transcended sports. So it was definitely one of the wilder days in the history of Canadian sport.
And I think one of the important things to consider with that dynamic is that hockey was not so popular in the States at the time. Like, don't get me wrong, it's still not super popular in the States when you compare it to the other big sports. But I think that was also part of the shock of the whole thing, because they were sending him to this untraditional hockey market after pretty much establishing himself as the greatest player ever during his time in Edmonton. And it makes me kind of think, it gets the old brain working, what would be the modern day equivalent? I don't even know if there is one that's a perfect fit.
No, there was Joe Montana leaving the 49ers, going to the Chiefs. You know, that was a shock. And, you know, certainly at the time, Montana was considered the greatest football player of all time. I think he's been supplemented now by Tom Brady. That's one that first comes to mind. You know, maybe we'll eventually look at the Juan Soto deal. We'll see. Mm. By the way, people betting on the Padres to win the World Series got down to as low as 10-1. I think they're 0-5. I don't think they've won since they've traded for Juan Soto.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit of MLB betting later, and I do have a couple thoughts on the Padres game tonight.
Okay. Well, we will get into that for sure. We're going to and maybe we'll go back and play. We'll play the report cause again, where I absolutely dominated. But I was mentioning before, Hard Knocks, which is sometimes a fun watch, sometimes gets pretty predictable. The HBO series where they chronicle a different NFL team. Right now it is on the Detroit Lions because of a good team said no. And during one of the days of training camp, here is running back Jamal Williams in his inspirational speech.
Well, I'll let y'all know, man, today is the minimum of effort. Do not give up. Do not feel like you're tired. Were you tired? Think of last year and think of that record. Every time I get tired or I think I can't go no more, I think of that record. Last year wasn't it. That ain't us. We can make it. Have some heart. I get emotional about this. I'm about to cry because I care about y'all. Do your best. Let's go. Lions on three. 1, 2, 3. Lions.
I got to tell you, I don't know where I was before in the Detroit Lions. And now suddenly, after hearing that, I'm like, Lions, what's their win total on FanDuel? And it's 6.5. You know, I was kind of staying away from that one, taking the over at -125. I think I'm going to take over 6.5 wins for the Lions just after hearing that speech.
I don't know if I would go that far, but I think that speech has got to be worth at least one win, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely it does.
Also, would you like it if in our pre-show meetings, if I kind of got us that riled up?
Yes. Yes, I would. I would absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
Okay, I'll try to mix in a little bit of that moving forward.
Yeah, because just get us inspired. Get us inspired before the show. Like we got Wesley Chang is going to be coming and joining us at 3 o'clock. Betting analyst with TSN Edge. I mean, that's exciting. Also, how about this? Tomorrow's Lotto 649 jackpot. It's an estimated $5 million plus one guaranteed $1 million prize. All you gotta do is text 649 and your name to 105050 for your chance to win $100 in Lotto 649 tickets with Encore. Standard message rates apply to all entries. Lotto 649. Get that 649 feeling. So again, text 649 and your name to 105050. Our Tuesday Top 5, which we'll do around 3:30 today, it's Top 5 Sports Icons. And this is because the news that Serena Williams has said she's going to retire after the U.S. Open. And she's one of those people that is, I mean, listen, if you're a sports icon, then you were great at your sport. I mean, full stop. That's the Captain Obvious point. But sports icon doesn't necessarily mean you were the greatest at your sport. Like, icon, and I think it means something different to anyone. For me, it's that person that just plays, that just gets into the psyche of our culture more than just what they do on the ice, on the diamond, on the field.
I thought you summed it up really well pre-show when you said the type of athlete that you could see having a segment on 60 Minutes, like a profile.
Yes, yeah.
And I do think that really characterizes the details outside of being good at your sport that make you an icon.
Like, I don't, I'm going to say right now, one of the people on the outside looking in, Tom Brady.
Not on my list either, but I will say he's just missed it.
Because for me, Tom Brady's not an icon, because for most of his career, he was part of the team. He was Patriot first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is not for me saying something like Serena, you know, is some selfish look at me, but, you know, just from the business side, the fashion, everything else, like, you know, she wasn't just an athlete, you know, an entertainer in some respects. And also, like, just breaking down barriers and you know, I mean, how many young African-American girls looked at her and said, oh, I can play tennis as well. You know, there's all these different things that can go into it. But, yeah, it comes down to this. If that athlete will be on CBS Sunday morning, a delightful show at 10 a.m., on 60 Minutes or on CNN, that to me, either being interviewed or being profiled in some sort of historical thing, that to me is what an icon is.
Yeah, because it shows that your scope is wider than that of just the sport that you play.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really one of the main criteria that goes into determining who is and isn't an icon. I will say, in my opinion, I think that there is a pretty clear top tier.
Yeah, there is.
For me, it is like 1, 2, 3 in any order. But I will say 4 or 5 totally out. I think you can make up 10 names for that spot.
Yeah. Oh, no. There's definitely going to be some crossover. But text the show at 10:50:50. Who for you are the greatest icons of all time? There are people that are going to go by one name, you know, like when you look at the list, it's definitely going to be one name people. Aaron Karolnik wrote in, Daniel Jones, Saquon Barkley, Kadarius Toney, Evan Neal, and Sterling Shepard, all members of the New York Giants, to which I say to you, Aaron Karolnik, bleep you. All right, coming up on the other side, someone from TSN I do like, Wesley Chang, TSN Edge contributor. We're going to take a look at some NFL futures bets, and can the Cowboys do something that hasn't been done in decades, win back-to-back NFC East titles? That is all coming up right here on Gameplay.